Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. Coming up on today's podcast, we have an interview with Molly Brennan and Paul Kalina from 500 Clown. They will be talking to Ann Nicholson Weber about their two latest shows now playing at the Steppenwolf Theater. And this is another interview that I think you're going to enjoy. We also have Chicago's theater news for you, so sit back and relax, and get ready to talk theater.
You're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm your host, Ann Nicholson Weber. I'm here today with Molly Brennan and Paul Kalina, who are two of the company called 500 Clown, and they're currently guest artists at Steppenwolf Theater, performing in repertory two of their shows, one the 500 Clown Macbeth and the other 500 Clown Frankenstein. So welcome, Molly and Paul.
Thanks for having us.
I guess we could start with trying to give those who haven't seen any of your shows some vague idea of what it is you do, which is pretty different from what anybody else does, I would say. Maybe, Molly, you could give us a little sense of that.
We've been called deconstructionists in both of the pieces we have at Steppenwolf. The three clowns, the other one is Adrian Danzig, who isn't present today. The three of us enter the space with the idea that we are going to tell the story of Macbeth, and there are a series of complications that keep us from telling the story of Macbeth, and through those complications, we tell the story of Macbeth. Frankenstein is similar. We get on stage, and we have no monster, and things aren't set up properly, and again, a series of problems lead us to tell the story by not being able to tell the story. We've been compared to a sporting event because we are highly physical, and also because although it is a play, or a piece of theater, I guess, is more accurate, we don't know what's going to happen. We have a set series of actions that we know we're going to perform throughout the night. When we perform those without an audience, they take about 40 minutes. When the audience is in the room, it goes from an hour to an hour 15. So how we get from one place to another is determined by the energy in the room. The partnering that Paul and Adrian and I do on stage, and whatever the audience has to offer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are clowns, and I'm interested to know, people come with expectations of what that means. And before we started the interview, Molly was doing a little interpretation of what most people's rather cliched idea of a clown is, with the big nose that goes, and that I think would not give people a good idea of what to expect when they see what your version of clowning is. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what you think it means to be a clown, and maybe also how that fits into the tradition of clowning.
Well, we as a company have kind of, because we're kind of a hybrid, we're not pure classical clown, which, you know, a lot of us say European style training, what Lecoq trained in his school, or Goliath, or some other people who, you know, if you see Bill Irwin or Slava, he had a show in New York. We're not so much that way. We're kind of a hybrid. We use whatever form is going to help us tell a story at the time. So we use a lot of clown, the base of what clown is for us, which is, you know, truth, hyper truth in a sense. What's really going on in the moment, what's really happening to us and between the audience, and honoring that and saying yes to that. But we also use, you know, what we would say realism. We also use melodrama. We also use mime. We also use kind of not sketch comedy, but sort of that broad style of kind of what Carol Burnett did in some of her clown style pieces, because I would consider her a clown as well. So we use all these forms in order to tell a story the way we wish to tell it. So we kind of stay away from it with each other because we also find that we have different ideas of what that pure sense is. So we kind of consider ourselves a hybrid of it.
The three of you, or the four of you, I should say, including Leslie, your director, don't, you were saying, might not say the same things about what clowning is?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. About what clowns are.
Are, yeah.
I think we are in agreement about clown as a verb.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We clown. We are present in the room. We do clown theater, which means that there is a through line. It's not just a random series of acts, but that we actually are telling a story. But as Paul said, we are open to the unpredictable, and we respond to that physically, emotionally, and intellectually. And that is that's something that Leslie, who's a scholar and who just wrote her dissertation for Northwestern, she talks about clown as a verb and that one clowns, and that's what we're doing. We're clowning the stories that we're telling, Macbeth and Frankenstein. We're clowning theater by not entering where one is supposed to enter, by doing things like going into the audience, by running the lights ourselves, by kind of breaking the rules that people expect.
Which is a huge clown thing. The breaking of expectation, the breaking of rules. That's the clown. It's constantly turning things on its ear or upside down to say, how does it look from this side? And is that really truth or is this truth? Or are they both truth? You know, and so they kind of make us really question and look at the world around us. And that is something we're very interested in doing, and we do. And there's a logic. You know, clown logic is... it's a bizarre logic. It's not the way, you know, you and I would look at a problem and we go, oh, well, if we just do this and this and this, we'll get this. The clowns look at it and go, well, if we do this and that, and then we take a Volkswagen and then a small can opener and then a sardine and then, we'll and a bucket of honey and we'll get this.
Uh-huh.
And we go, what?
We were watching the Marx Brothers last night, Paul and I, and there's a bit where Harpo plucks the buttons off of bellhop's jacket and eats them, and then uses the bellhop to rest his foot, and like that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Is like you go into a real environment that people are familiar with and recognize, and then you do things with the things in that environment that are unexpected, and usually that's to a humorous effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us to laughter, which seems very important to what you do, but perhaps not as important as people expect going in. My sense of the two shows, which I've seen, was that, I mean, that there was a lot of hysterical laughter from the audience, more from one of the audiences than the other of the two performances I saw. But I didn't get the feeling that your main goal as you walked into the theater was to get as many laughs as possible. No. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and clown is, of course, clown makes us laugh, but it's not the sole purpose of the clown. Clown is also to make us cry, also to make us get angry, also to make us just have an array of emotions, because the clown does as well. A lot of times we laugh at it through, we understand it, we see it, we notice it, but it's not the main goal of it.
Well, and obviously you've chosen two very dark texts as your jumping off place. Why? What makes those good places to start if you're clowns?
Well, something that I've noticed in doing this work is I can't clown in chaos. I have to clown in order, because if everything is chaotic, then you don't see the clown.
Because you can't, there's no expectations for you to play against.
Right, right.
There's no rule.
And comedy is usually, or often, has that chaotic effect. And so, you know, if we clowned Midsummer Night's Dream, that would be for people who are scholars of Midsummer Night's Dream, as opposed to, say, a general audience. I don't think that you have to know Macbeth or Frankenstein to enjoy our work. But there's an understanding that what we are tackling is something very serious, something that people take very seriously, and that we're we are taking it very seriously, but we're not doing a very good job, and that's what's funny. Whereas, as I said, if you do that with comedy, it has to be about jokes, and we don't tell jokes.
Right.
That's not what we're doing.
It's about being clever.
No, right. We say don't be clever, because that separates your head from your body, and we're more interested in the visceral effect. Of course, there's an intellectual effect as well, as you you experience things viscerally, and we watch people pitch forward in their seats, concerned that we're going to break our necks, mm-hmm. and we are concerned as well. I mean, that's, that's the other thing is that we're doing some really dangerous things on stage. Mm-hmm. And so for people to have that visceral response to what's happening in the room, and then, the conversation that comes after the show, and like, oh, wow, I didn't think they were doing Macbeth, but they were, or whatever.
Right.
And I think that, if we were clowning comedy, it's redundant.
Well, one thing that people may not expect is that, for instance, to take the Macbeth and talk a little bit more concretely, the project that you've set for your clowns is to reach up to a crown that's hanging up above the stage. And in the course of the evening, the vying for that clown ends up in a real bloodbath. And the piece gets really distressing, really upsetting, just like Macbeth does. I mean, this violence gets let loose and takes over and leaves just carnage on the stage, and it gets very serious, even though it continues to be funny throughout, which I thought was brilliant and very effective and clearly had to have been part of your purpose.
Yeah, well, and without those moments, then the comedy is, or the laughter is not as profound,
mm-hmm.
and what you're laughing at. We're also interested in having people laugh, having a great time, and then going, wait a minute, what was I laughing at? Why was I laughing at that?
Right.
Because we do that in, we're interested in turning those tables and hopefully challenging people to think, all of us, including ourselves. There are times when we come off stage going, wow, why was I pursuing that? Wow, that was so crazy tonight. That just went into such a wild place that I went there. And we'll look at ourselves sometimes. There have been times where I've walked off stage going horrified with where I went with the show, but driven by either the audience or my partners or myself, and we're like, wow, that's in me?
Right.
And so that's interesting to us as well. I always point back to Shaw. Shaw was always like, get them laughing and then you can shove anything down their throat.
Uh-huh.
But there's something to that. When they're laughing, and we found that the physical risk brings people's emotional level accessibility much closer to the surface, so they're willing to go on that ride with us.
Right. Well, let's talk about your relationship to the audience, because that was perhaps to me the most striking thing about the work you do. And I was saying before the interview began that in decades and decades of going to theater, I'm one of those people who, when audience participation is invited, is shrinking into my seat and praying that I won't be noticed or asked somehow to be part of the show. And this was my first experience ever of being put into a place where I would have been willing, that I would have been willing to say something or, beat you up when I was asked to, which happens in the show. I wonder if we can try to get at how you do that. It seemed really extraordinary to me.
I think a big step is that we are willing to take risks. And just like any relationship, non-theatrical included, you look at the movies we enjoy about strong leaders, generals that their battalion will follow them anywhere because that general is willing to take a bullet for any of his men. If we're like, okay, here's the play and this is what we're willing to do. What are you guys willing to do?
Yeah.
That's one point, but there are many more.
And we don't have, sometimes with audience participation, the performer has all the cards. See, we control it. Even though to a certain extent we are in control, but there are times where I go out in that audience And there's no idea what you guys could do. And some people have. Like, I've, in Frankenstein, a guy lifted me up over his head and threw me into the aisle, and Adrian had to go from pursuing me to catching me and making sure everybody else was okay.
And for people listening, Paul is not a petite guy. This man was enormous.
Uh-huh. He was big. So, you know, so there's something about that as well where we go, yeah, we aren't in control of the situation, and we're not going to make you look like a fool. Mm-hmm. We're not there to get the laughter from making you look like an idiot. That's not where we're coming from.
Yes,
and
that's right.
Sometimes you can see in shows. And we're not interested in that. We're interested in, okay, what's this experience? And you're going to be a part of this, and you're going to help move this story forward, you know, and we're actually going to be grateful for what you offer.
Well, that strikes me. That's interesting, because I was thinking as you were talking about being in a classroom with one of those professors who asks for, you know, an answer to a question, but clearly has one right answer in mind and is just waiting till the star pupil says what it is they need before he'll move on or she'll move on. And I would imagine that part of what must make it possible for people to just enter in is the feeling that there is no right answer. Is that right? But how do you convey that?
Well, we actually have, I mean, I don't want to call it a system, but we do have a series of things that we do. We enter in both shows, in Macbeth. Well, I don't want to give too much away, but we have time with the audience before the shows start. And we can use that time to scan people out and go, this person is going to be really into it. Oh, this person's shrinking back. I'm going to leave that person alone, maybe.
Oh.
And maybe they'll come out later. But this person's like forward, and they want something. So that's one thing we do. Another thing is we start setting up very early in both shows that it matters that you're here. And what I mean is, like, and I don't mean that in a sentimental way. It means if you're reading your program, when I'm doing something that I've worked on, I'm going to wait till you put your program down because I want you to see it. And if you come in late, you have supported what we're doing by coming in late, because you're going to move the plot forward by the fact that you decided to come in late. Like Paul as king acquired four wives.
Great.
And a eunuch. And so, like, saying yes to uh-huh. anything the audience has to offer,
uh-huh.
from something as subtle as a sneeze that we stop and look at, to something more overt, like someone getting up to go to the bathroom and us stopping and being affected by that. And so I think there's this kind of learning process that the audience goes through of, like, oh, what I do in the room matters. And whether that's actually, you know, that conscious, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time that we need people to play the village, by the time we need the audience, I think that we have invited them in a variety of ways. We've made evaluations of where people are at. And so when it starts to become a dialogue, you know, we've set it up so that people are willing to go there with us.
Yeah.
In addition to the fact that we're doing these crazy things that could cause us a lot of pain. And I think that there's a thing that happens where you're like, gosh, I'm not going to climb up 15 feet in the air on a rickety thing that could possibly fall down, but I'll put my fist in the air and pretend to be a villager,
right.
You know, like that. I
right.
think that just is mm-hmm. like we have a process and we talk about it, about, like, you know, not saying no to the audience, that they're not wrong. We've extended the invitation, and there's a huge risk in that. And whatever you give us is something we're going to use.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we don't bring them, you know, people are not being forced out of their seat up on stage in front of other people that are on them. No, they're in the comfort of their seat. If worst comes, the worst that we do is maybe, you know, I've had some people stand up, but those are people who are totally willing to stand up. And usually because it's going to turn back on me. I'm going to look like the fool.
Right.
And that's why I'll have them stand up. And they're the hero. And it's like, whoa, okay, you sit down. You know?
Yeah.
It's a great thing. It's an empowering thing, not a again, you know, using them as the butt of the joke.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, there must be, though, some kind of balance that you have to strike, because on the one hand, you're inviting the audience to be part of the process. On the other hand, you have not only points of the story that you have to hit, but you have very dangerous physical theater that can only work if it's very precise and very carefully set up. So there's got to be some non-negotiable, let's say, parts of the show. And how do you go back and forth? And how do you, if you have, I mean, I imagine that means sometimes you do have to say no. Someone wants to take this some way that just isn't going to fit.
Yeah, I think, you know, this working in the Steppenwolf space, we have a greater distance from the audience than sometimes we have, but we've had people come up on stage before. Now, if someone decided for some reason that they wanted to come up on stage at a time when we knew the actual stage isn't safe, then what would happen is one of us would communicate with that person and say, where you're standing right now is not safe, and I need you to go and sit back in your seat. Mm-hmm. Like, we have the ability to, like, I mean, people would call it breaking out of character, but we're not really in character. Mm. We're in a state to tell the story. But if somebody came up at a crucial point where it's like, if you step on that, man, we are all screwed or whatever, their hand and say, hey, you can't be there. The other thing that happens too, though, is the audience takes care of themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, if the audience is all in one place and you have one person who's inebriated or, you know, has something else going on and it isn't fit to the room, the audience often takes care of itself. And we don't have to do anything. Uh-huh. You know, we just watch it happen.
And takes care of us sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. A 5-year-old boy standing on his chair and saying saying about the way Paul was being treated, you leave him alone!
Right.
Totally unsolicited. Just,
right.
You know. Great.
Well, so this, because the audience has such a role, then the different character of the audience coming into the show obviously matters hugely. And I'm interested how you, for instance, let me start with the audience I saw Macbeth with, which was the first preview. And it was, to say warm would not even begin. It was boiling. It was so responsive. Laughing, I felt almost too hard at things. Some people had come in with an expectation that this was going to be hysterically funny, and it didn't quite, to me, match what you were doing. So let's just take a very concrete example like that. How do you respond to that? Is that okay? If it's not, how do you try to change the chemistry?
Well, I think we work with it. We try to meet it. And then hopefully if we find it's taking control of the show and the story's not being told, then we'll meet that and hopefully we won't what we'll call break out of the story so much. We won't lean into them and let them take us on offshoots mm-hmm. of what the main, what we call our tight 40, that constructed tight 40. We'll lean into that more so that hopefully they will tone down if it's spiraling out of control and we're losing the through line.
I mean, do you have to just acknowledge less when that's happening? Is that what
sometimes
that means?
Sometimes mm-hmm. we'll just not, you know, people be shouting things and throwing things or whatever, and unless it's something really major that needs to be dealt with, we'll just keep moving through, because then sometimes they'll go, oh, they'll settle down mm-hmm. and then the show can find its rhythm and a new dialogue with the audience that's mm-hmm. perhaps more in cooperation with mm-hmm. what's being done.
Mm-hmm. One of the effects I'm reviewing my experience of it, an audience often feels very collective, and that's a good feeling. We're one entity. When you allow people to act individually within the audience, that experience shifts a little bit. I think if you get back to a collectivity with those individuals, it's even more exciting. But I can imagine that it doesn't always happen. I mean, if people are shouting out things that I in the audience don't like, and I have to turn on a fellow audience member emotionally, that's a very different experience than when we're all quietly sitting in our seats experiencing it in a dark room without a...
Very exciting. We've had that.
Yeah. And you, I just wanted to, you brought up the dark room. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you noticed, but you're not sitting in a dark room.
It wasn't dark.
Sitting, the audience is lit at different levels at different times during the show, sometimes very lit and sometimes dimly lit, but never in black. I don't think. unless we're all
pitch
in black.
Dark,
the
right?
Very,
yeah.
The very end of Mac, but that's, yeah, that's right. It. Right. I mean, but mostly, yeah, we because we need to see you. We need to see your eyes. I mean, that's part of our work is about something happens to us, we turn out to the audience, and we make that communication from stage.
Right. Well, I imagine the more the lights are up, the more we feel like we're invited to participate. Is that right? I mean, that's
probably
how it seems to me. I would imagine that would be part of how you're using
the
lighting. Right, right.
You don't get to hide.
Right.
So,
well, talk a little bit, because you mentioned about you have the freedom to step out of character, and then you disclaimed that and said, well, we're not exactly in character. But the three of you each have a name which you use in both shows. So it seems like there is some construct there that you're working from. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I don't know. They're slightly different in both shows. For me, I can speak for myself, how I approach it. I bring out different elements of my person.
What's your character's name?
Shank. So you may be seeing highlighted aspects in Frankenstein, and they're not maybe what's more prominent in Frankenstein is not as prominent in Macbeth. You know, you're seeing my own ambition, my aggression, my need for control. That's Paul. Those are my issues, and I blow those up because they become great things when they meet, you know, Molly's stuff or Adrian's stuff. And when those things hit, there's a chemistry and there's things that happen. So it creates a really exciting situations. And then in Frankenstein, I'm slower. I takes time for Shank to process, and that's Paul's methodical. When I get into really, I'm not quite sure what's going on. I slow down, and so there's a different aspect of me there.
So what's consistent? What makes Shank?
Well, I think the physicality. I think I'm always strong in the physicality. Like, I lift a lot in both shows. I'm hauling a lot in both shows. I carry a lot in both shows. So I think it's that Midwest corn-fed boy is throughout, you know.
And Molly, maybe you could just talk a little bit about your alter ego, if that's the
Kevin,
right.
Yeah. Kevin is, when I'm in Kevin, again, it's highlighting these things that are about me, that are me, and they're turned up, you know, and recognized and used. And the thing that in both shows I have in common is my I actually have some language skill.
Uh-huh.
A lot.
I know a lot of the play Macbeth. I know it. And so I have certain things that I do the same every night, but then there are times when the situation just calls for some line of dialogue, and so I'll pull it up.
Another line of Shakespeare's Macbeth, you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. Frankenstein, I have the novel Frankenstein and read from it, trying to match what's happening on stage, going back and forth between trying to match what's happening on stage with the book, and then also sometimes reading the book to make something happen on stage. But this need for story, which is a Molly thing, you know, becomes in Kevin like a very singular drive, and the need to be heard, and the need to be seen, and the need to show everyone my language ability is an embarrassing thing for Molly. It's a glorious thing for Kevin. Throwing tantrums is something that Kevin does, something Molly tries not to do and is embarrassed by, but Kevin
not.
That's nice. Yeah, like that, this is who there isn't a lot of shame in clown. We go there with it, but like the shame comes from a different kind of failure than like in the human world. You know, like we do feel ashamed in both shows about the way we've treated each other or whatever, but it takes a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not ashamed of our attributes like human beings are. We're ashamed by our actions, which is really interesting because I think that we could use more of that in the human world. I think that we could do better if we felt less shameful of ourselves as people and took more responsibility and felt more shame about
what
our actions.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something kinda, I'm just thinking of now.
I think that's great. But that's I think that relates to a clown, the clown's purpose in has always been the clown's purpose in society, you know, which was to point those things out and say, hey, you know, why are you feeling so shameful about your own, you know, your own stuff? Why don't you take a look at what that is doing to the people around you and the world around you?
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I was thinking about the expression, he really looked like a clown, or I really felt like such a clown. I mean, obviously, if you're a clown, that's not bad. So this idea of shame about, I guess it's really, when we say that, we mean that people looked down on us, thought we looked idiotic or something. And your job is, to some degree, to be idiotic, right? I mean, not
to a large degree.
Yeah. I mean, we are, it's the fool. There's a reason why the fool is... the reason why the king had the fool. The fool is the one who could walk around the people and hear that they're going to, you know, charge the castle and cut the king's head off. You know, I mean, there's a reason why we have him and need him. You know, I think it's a pretty exciting time, actually. I think, I don't know, don't you think, Mal? I think we see more and more clown coming back. He's merging hugely, he, she, it. It's just... you're seeing a lot of it coming forward, and I think it's really in reaction to the world now.
And many religions and religious traditions have a clown,
the holy fool,
and a lot of Christian denominations have cut that out. Carnival was the day to clown the church.
Right.
We don't have that here. We cannot laugh at ourselves. We cannot laugh at our leaders. Mm-hmm. Like, that becomes this...
we're just setting up for the fall.
Yeah, it's like, you have to have that. You have to have humor.
Well, and who's the fool then, you know?
Yeah, right. You are a fool.
You are a fool.
If you can't make fun of yourself, if you can't see your own wrongs and your own weaknesses, if you can't take a joke, you are a fool.
Right.
A real fool.
Right. So you have to make room for that part of human nature as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm interested, you're talking about a resurgence of clowning. Are there other other groups or other people's work that you're...
There's a lot of groups out there. There's now a clown theater festival in New York. We had started one a long time ago, City of Fools here. There are a number of clown companies in Chicago doing their versions of clown theater or clowning. There's, you know, besides that, you have the Big Apple Circus Clown Care Unit, which are in the hospitals, but it really comes from a very strong place of healing and the healing aspect of the clown.
Stephen Colbert,
man.
Who, like, you know, he is this
huge
this
clown.
Guy that states opinions, and you, from the point of view of this is how I feel, and
had the guts to do it 10 feet away from the President of the United States at that press night dinner,
Oh my gosh,
and had
amazing.
The guts to go, here we go, and that is the true fool in front of the king,
right?
Going, here it is, and look at what people think of you, and take a look at what's really going on, and doing it right there, and the king has to sit there and be laughed at.
Well, it was. I found your work so valuable and so interesting, and I'm very glad that clowning is having such a resurgence, and that you're part of that.
Thank you.
Chicago, and welcome to another empirical episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you Chicago's theater news for the week of July 2nd, 2007. Bohemian Theater Ensemble will be presenting Moises Kaufman's off-Broadway hit, Gross Indecency, The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde. That's right, the company that brought you Sideshow, which incidentally recently won 5 Jeff citations, We'll be bringing you the tale of playwright Oscar Wilde and the times in which he lived. The show is set in April 1895 and offers insight into Oscar Wilde's genius and his human frailty. Moises Kaufman's Gross Indecency, The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde, opens on July 27th and will be running through late August at the Boho Theater at Heartland Studio. For more information, you can go to bohotheater.com, and that's theater with an R-E, or, of course, you can click on over to the Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Well, this summer is turning out to be a good one. Looking Glass Alice is back home here in Chicago. That's right, Looking Glass Theater's namesake show and 2005 runaway hit Looking Glass Alice is now running here through August 12th. The show was directed by David Catlin and is a physical approach to the Lewis Carroll novel. Movement-based performances have always been a staple at Looking Glass Theater, and now you can see one of the best shows they ever made. The show, incidentally, is currently touring around the nation, but you can catch it here, again, through August 12th, at the Looking Glass Theater at Water Tower Works. That's located at 921 North Michigan Avenue. For more information, there's a Now Playing section on a very popular website that you can check out, and I'm sure you know which website that is. We have a little bit of theater administrative news for you. Red Moon Theater has announced that Christopher Schramm is their new executive director. Christopher Schramm comes from the National Foundation for Advancement in the Arts in Miami, and he is going to bring a lot to the business plan and long-term goals for Red Moon Theater. Congratulations, Christopher Schramm. Also in other news, Gregory Copeland has announced that he will be leaving his position as executive director for About Face Theater to head over to the West Coast. About Face Theater has already appointed an interim executive director, that is former producing director Heather Schumacher. This comes right as the company is getting ready to launch its 12th season, which will include not only the Chicago premiere of the Tony-nominated hit The Little Dog Laughed, but a new world premiere of a new play by artistic director Eric Rosen in partnership with Steppenwolf Theater. Well, I can't thank you enough for listening to this empirical episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare quote of the week. The following quote comes from The Tragedy of Julius Caesar, Act 1, Scene 2. Men at some time are masters of their fates. Well, I can't thank you enough for listening to this little podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So, until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Molly Brennan and Paul Kalina for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.